This is an interview with General George Marshall at Pinehurst, December the 7th, 1956. Recorded by to questions by Forrest C. Pope. Sergeant Heffner ran the machine.
We can try that one time, see if it is, General.
I can't understand you.
I say we'll try it one time to see if it is working.
Well, I don't want to answer a lot of this stuff if it isn't registered. Because it's rather...
All right, I think it's all right now, General. Because its light is indicating that it's working all right.
As to the basic weaknesses, colon. There were some of these that could not be eliminated as they were inherent in the basic laws governing the National Guard. The principal trouble was the very short training period for the men. And as a few hours once a week would not suffice to replace the basic training which required us in the regular service on a 12-hour day, the very strenuous work, many months, 6 or more in getting men ready for the war. Now, I want to be certain this is registering.
It is registering, but I just want to, because sometimes your voice goes down, you see. I'll just get it close enough so you don't have to strain.
It is only possible in a National Guard organization to get the men, but once a week, except for the 2 weeks in the summer. I did find it possible as an extra effort beside the law to get the Illinois National Guard for longer periods. But the lack of training, which resulted in the 2 hours a week, was the, or rather constituted the basic weakness of the National Guard system, which you could not cure unless you had a longer period of training. And that was one reason why I was so anxious to see compulsory military training installed, because I wanted to see it reach the point where you couldn't, the man would have to enlist in the National Guard after he finished this 6 months compulsory training in order to clear himself from further service. He'd be on a reserve basis. And as soon as the ranks of the National Guard were filled with these men that had had 6 months basic training, the opportunities for the development of a highly disciplined organization were all present. The next difficulty was the question of officers. The amount of training they had before they got their commissions, which in most instances was very little. It is not possible to send them to schools in the numbers that would meet the requirements of the National Guard. And it is also quite evident that the very men we wanted most couldn't spare that time. They were too successful in business or the law or medicine or whatever their practice was. So it resulted in a complete lack of thoroughness in the training of the officers. This again was one of the reasons that I thought that as a byproduct of the compulsory military training, we would get a totally different result. because we could commission officers only from those who had had this compulsory training. So your control of the National Guard would be in the men, in the hands of the men who had been basically trained, and which was entirely absent. As I recall, the divisions we first called in from the National Guard, we required them to have 7 weeks of this basic training, preliminary training, as it were. And they went on through that and passed to their other work with great complaint from commanders who felt that that was time wasted, that 7 weeks was entirely too long. After we really took over these divisions, largely with a change of command, we had to do this training all over again. For the regular, for the established forces that we controlled, we were then having almost a year's basic training of the individuals before we put them into the ranks. Later, it was 6 months of very strenuous work, very strenuous days and nights, all of which was missing, is missing in the normal National Guard training. Only a high degree of discipline as developed by this intensive training makes it possible to meet the demands of the modern battlefield. It requires a very high state of discipline, and there's no time to get it afterwards. You're in there. And this individual training doesn't come as readily on a divisional basis as it does on the individual basis of training the man as an individual and then assigning him to a larger unit. Now, another thing in connection with the officers was, it was very hard to get a correct judgment of their efficiency, their qualifications, because here you stepped into the realm of politics, just as you did in the commissioning of officers in a great many of the states. And in their handling of the men and all, it is very difficult, short of a war basis, to have men discipline their neighbors during the peacetime training in a manner that is required in order to get a strict compliance with the with the orders that are so necessary to build up a satisfying state of discipline. In the main, the weakness was the complete lack of time to basically train the individuals in the Guard, the political influences involved in the officer corps, and the lack of a method of firmly establishing the qualifications of the candidates for promotion or commissions. Two, with relation to Mr. Fry's mention in his biography of me, he speaks of a special training procedure I followed in New York, in Illinois. I can't very well go into that because it's a very lengthy proposition, and it'll take quite some time, and I'll have to reserve this to talk to you later. Three, I confine myself in my efforts in the training of the National Guard to dealing with the Illinois National Guard. I took things as they were and the rules and regulations as they were, and they responded very, very well. I would say they responded with goodwill to the procedure, whatever the lacks were. Four, I am not sufficiently familiar now with the reorganization of the National Guard after 1945. But what little I do know of it, I think it didn't correct these basic weaknesses. 6. I feel the National Guard is part and parcel of our system, and we will always have it with us. Whether it's the complete provision of trained forces or not, I do not know. But if we must depend on that, we have a long ways to go in fitting these men for the strain of a modern fight. We have to remember now that while we're heretofore, we've had years to get ready for a war. The next time we will have no time at all, because whoever makes an issue of war will be prepared to try to get the best of us from the very start, because that would be our weakest moment for a large trained force. The only way I can see to, under the present conditions, to improve on this, short of universal military training, would be to have a very few troops take their turn, we'll say a 5-year period, of being very highly trained and giving a great deal of time in order to be ready for immediately employment, and then being relieved from that pressure by another group of divisions, which would be determined largely by the amount of transport that could be readily made available. We would know right off that we couldn't transport a large number of troops abroad. And if our military policy remains the same, that is to keep the fighting out of the Western world, and as we have in the past, it would be limited at the start to the divisions for which we could find transportation. At the same time, others that would remain at home and gradually establish themselves in efficiency. During the period, they were available as home guards, as it were. What changes, if any, are still needed? I'm not sufficiently familiar with the law now, but I would say, as far as I know, nothing has been done to cure the greatest weakness, which is the time element and the quality of the man that is commissioned. The only remedy to this that I know of is this compulsory military training, where the graduate of the 6 months course, or whatever months may be the term, can be assigned to the National Guard for the ranks for a period of, say, 3 years, and meanwhile would be a reserve for the ranks of the National Guard after that period. I know of no other way to get a solid basis of training in the ranks of the National Guard. When you look back and realize how long it took us to get these divisions ready for service, I think the average, I'm guessing, was about 20 months. I know some divisions were 22 months getting ready to go abroad. Well, if we become involved in first-line fighting in the first week of the war, a system of that sort is not tolerable. As to 7, my work with General Palmer and others in the effort to get Congress to establish a citizen army instead of a small professional army, as General March wanted. I think I will have to talk to you about this at some length. Eight. as to the reserve program, its principal weakness was an effort had been made to get as large a reserve of officers as possible. And that was quite contrary to my conception. I felt that we ought to have a small reserve, very well sustained and trained. With the funds available for this large mass of officers, we couldn't possibly do that. I thought it was very much more to the point to start off with a modest number who had been given first-class opportunities for their training, instead of, as it was, so little money available that the government could do very little for the individual officer. 9. What steps did I take to strengthen this program? Well, almost immediately on my becoming chief of staff, we were moving into a situation that demanded the assignment of reserve, great many reserve officers to active duty. And there we had to put them in before they had completed any additional training, which wasn't so good, but it was the best could be done under the circumstances. There was no period for a new preparation arrangement for the training of reservists, because we were into the thing, into a mobilization, almost immediately on my appointment as chief of staff. Prior to that, the funds available for the training of reserves, as I have indicated, already indicated, were so limited that very little could be done to the for the individual. And so the standard of training of the officer was very small. The regular component of the ground army, again, was so small, there was almost no place to assign these men for professional experience. Somebody hazarded the statement, I recall, that all the non-commissioned officers of the regular army in this country could find reserve seats in the Yankee Stadium. That may be correct or incorrect, I don't know, but there were very few of them. And of course, the numbers to be increased were tremendous. However, I feel very sharply that we tried to get numbers rather than training, which I thought was a cardinal mistake. This attitude towards the Navy, set up in time of peace, may have been partially due to the President's pro-Navy feelings, but the main point was the Navy was dealing in something that you had to have years of construction preliminary to making an effective result. The feeling was that you could make a ground army very quickly, but you couldn't build a battleship in a week. It was a matter of years. As a matter of fact, the same thing held with the air, that they had to have a lot of extra training for the air. Well, the hardest thing in the world to train is the ground army of infantry and artillery. In fact, I never saw it perfectly trained except during the latter part of the war, because everything you do is under extraordinarily difficult circumstances, which is not the case with the others. For example, in the Navy, I think it was the ship custom that everybody should take a bath, if the time prevailing, before going into action, and put on clean underwear. The probability was he'd had a night's sleep in his regular bunk. With the Army, it was quite the other way around. The probability before a battle was that he'd been in a series of marches, some of them possibly forced marches. He'd been pushed to the verge of exhaustion. He was wet, because it always seems to rain at such times, and muddy, and he had to sleep in those clothes. He had no chance to get a change of garments on the eve of action or for a long time after that. And yet the moment when his high courage was necessary was, as a rule, at dawn when he woke up half frozen to deal with an enemy he couldn't see, and his machine guns and artillery as a rule, couldn't see except through the eyes of a single observer. And another thing, the artillery, which had to furnish its close support, was out of sight, and he might never see the guns that were supporting him, all of which required a very high state of training, and higher than that of any other force that I know of. Most of the training in the Navy, you had a specific duty to perform, a specific place to perform that duty. And you went, as I've explained, in a prepared state to do that. That was not at all the case with the Army. It was exactly the opposite. And the chances were 9 out of 10. Certainly for the artillery, you never saw your enemy, and you never saw the place in which you fired until dawn came the morning of the battle. All of this required very high training in order that it might be carried out with precision and efficiency. Then there was another very, I think, specific reason why it is much easier to obtain funds for the Navy than for the Army, and for the air than for the ground army. The Navy was highly photogenic. A column of battleships, the supporting cruisers, scurrying destroyers. It was a very spectacular thing. There's nothing spectacular about a ground army setup. Matter of fact, the better it's done, the less there is to see, which made it very, very hard to deal with men who were being educated constantly to admire the tremendously impressive sight of these great ships plunging through the waves and stirring up quite a weight behind them. This, I think, presented one of the great difficulties of the thing, because a member of Congress didn't see the ground army in action very well. He was taken out to see part of the thing and all. But the time that really counted was the night, the marches up to the final night, and the fatigues and discomforts, hardships of that night, and where you were when morning came, when you got ready for the first effort. The airship is very spectacular, the Air Force, and the ships are very spectacular. But again, this is the nearest approach to push-button warfare, just as it is with the Navy. But there's nothing push-button at all about practically anything in the ground army. I think part of our trouble in this goes back to our days of our ancestors being experts with the rifle, and the rifle being on the conventional deer prongs over the fireplace. Every man in those days, certainly every man on the frontier, was an expert handler of a gun. He knew how to track, he knew how to screen himself, and he knew how to shoot with precision. Now, practically all of that vanished, and the major portion of the boys we got were city boys. And I know when we went into the First World War, I went over the first unit, and there was such talk about that they were trained marksmen, trained woodsmen. Well, most of them hadn't seen a weapon except in the shooting gallery, and I'd never been in the woods in their life other than the park, which made it a very difficult change. Now, the farmer boy, in a sense, was better prepared. He probably moved more slowly and deliberately, but he knew the open country. And his difficulty came in handling himself with a crowd, to which he was utterly unaccustomed. As to the money, involved in educational orders, the amounts are very small, but they should be screened for percentages against the total appropriation available and the needs of the ground army at this time. The army needed everything. At this time, it is dealing with a 40-year-old rifle. I think it's 40 years, and had to be rearmed. Its artillery had to be rearmed. I was much criticized for continuing the 57, the 75 millimeter guns. I did that because we had no ammunition for the new 105 guns, and we had very few of these, and it'd take a long time to get them. Meanwhile, we had to have some artillery. So the only way was to use the 75 and the large accumulation of ammunition which was left over from the First World War. Those were facts, and we had to have something. And that entered into most all these things. There was such a limited amount of money available. We had the 105, we had the new automatic rifle, we had the new machine guns. The poorest product gotten out by the ordnance at this time, and I don't know whose fault it was, and it was the first thing that reached the troops, was the 37 millimeter cannon to as an anti-tank gun. It was, I say 37, maybe it was 47, I don't recall. This was archaic when it was issued to the troops. It was the last ordnance product. We had had very great difficulty with the ordnance department in the past, but I think that had been largely washed out by the operations of the general staff in coming into what models should be manufactured. Another great difficulty I found with the ordnance, and I got into this by an early visit to the ordnance, almost immediately after I was made Deputy Chief of Staff. I went to them, the Chief of Ordnance and his Assistant Chief of Ordnance, and asked them to tell me all the things they needed, all the things they lacked. And there I found, for example, that while the big industries retooled almost completely every 3 years or more, they had some machines in those arsenals that had been there 50 years, and there was no money to get any replacement of any kind. So there was so much required that only a very little bit could be apportioned to educational officers, educational orders. It is a very fine thing to have the educational order, but by gosh, we had to have something actual that we could use immediately.
I think that 37 millimeter was referred to as a one-pounder one time.
Where I said 75 had a tank gun, it was 37 millimeter.
Yeah, one-pounder.
Turn it off. Question 14. The system for developing new weapons. This was guided in the main from the chief of the branch, chief of artillery, chief of infantry, and so forth. Also to special boards that existed, notably one for the infantry at Benning, one for the artillery at Bragg, and several others. There were sections in the staff in the War Department that were busily engaged on any new prospect that came up. My reactions and actions were motivated largely by a general survey of the whole setup, or lack of pieces in that setup, and the proposals of officers. It's inherent in an army, a large organization, with a control like that of the War Department, general staff and chiefs of branches, that it should be conservative. And when a man comes up with a new idea, unless he's handles himself very carefully, he merely stirs up opposition. In the first place, a great many new things are proposed, a great many out of Congress, a great many by outsiders, and a great many by individual army officers. Only a few of these are practical propositions, and it has to be. Yet you had to clear the atmosphere, clear the air of all the impractical ones, each one of which is somebody's favorite son. I tried to make it a point to see the proponent of any one of these matters. I remember one in which an officer was in rather bad odor, it seemed, by his feelings about the artillery and the fact that they were not forward-looking, and there was a great lack in the training, particularly the artillery that was being mounted in the tanks. Well, the feeling against him was rather strong. When I heard this, I sent for him, and I had him lay out for me all of his thoughts on the subject, his arguments, and I told him at the time that about half his trouble was that his presentation wasn't a coordinated affair, but was a highly prejudiced and almost semi-insulting procedure. I thought he had good ideas. As a matter of fact, I made use of them, particularly about the technique of employing artillery installed in tanks. But he had successfully antagonized practically the whole staff by getting out of temper with them all. It required a little more subtlety than that, because they were in a firm position and he was not. I saw any number of these men, and I will come to one of the most notable cases later in regard to the Jeep. I made it quite a point to see the foreign representatives of any of the new tools that we were building, like tanks, for example, and other things of that nature, and to find out what the other fellow was doing who was fighting and using them on the battlefield. This was notably the case in relation to the settlement of quantity production of tanks, as to what model it should be, as between the British conception and our conception. Well, I heard all of our arguments, and then I got a couple of Britishers in, just as myself alone, and told them to talk very frankly to me and tell me how they saw this thing. And I got their point of view from them. But in short, it was this, as it seemed to me afterwards, and it worked out well too. As to mobility, speed, handling, and matters of that sort, the American tank was incomparable. The British was very poor. We had used these procedures in connection with the harvest field, notably one man out in west of the Mississippi River who had great numbers of tractors and things of that sort. I know we brought him in and almost lost the value of his use because there got to be a congressional movement behind him, and of course that just clouds the whole issue. I was trying to get that part, not get it from the British. I remember, for example, that there came a time when the British wanted 15 of the earliest form of heavy bombers. I'm just trying to think of the name that we called them. Anyway, I'll remember the name in a minute. Very common one. The reason they wanted them was their people down on the river in the slums were being heavily bombed. And Mr. Churchill in particular said they needed encouragement, and the only encouragement they could get was if we were bombing the enemy as heavily as they were being bombed in the slums of London. Well, the trouble was that the bombers, German bombers working on England, were taking off just across the channel. Our bombers working on Berlin had to fly a long distance. And the only thing we had that would reach there, the British had nothing that would reach Berlin, were this particular anti-bomber bomber that whose name I've forgotten at the moment. So they wanted this bomber to get something to Berlin so that they could tell these people they were bombing Berlin. At that time, there was a law which made it imperative that anything that was turned over to the British or the French had to be approved by me personally as chief of staff of army equipment. I thought it was quite clearly to my mind an unconstitutional law because the president was commander-in-chief, and for a subordinate of the commander-in-chief to be able to tell him he can do or he can't do is kind of ridiculous. However, that's the way the law read, and it hadn't been tested out, so it fell to me to operate under the terms of this law. Well, I was very careful about it. I tried not to crowd the issue at all, and I thought it was imperative that Congress feel that they could trust me, and then I could get them to do things otherwise they would oppose. Well, this was one of them, and it's the only time that I recall that I did something that there was a certain amount of duplicity in it. Actually, what I was doing was very right, and I didn't realize how right. And I could have given that reason most effectively, but it wasn't that we turned over these bombers to England, that from an Englishman I found out what the trouble was. Our fellows were reporting back that they'd turned these, very reluctantly, turned these bombers over to the British, and they were not being used. In fact, they were standing out in the field, the grass growing up around the tires. I sent for a Britisher, and I asked him to explain this thing to me. Very frankly, and I wouldn't quote him. And he told me very quickly what the point was. He said they couldn't use these bombers. Their defensive arrangements were lacking. They had no tail guns, for one thing, which is the most serious thing, which would mean they'd all get shot down. There were two or three other things about it that I accepted their version because I was familiar with the manufacture of these things. And had been out at the plant and gone over them while they were being turned out. And I could see exactly what they're talking about. You know, our fellows were arguing about all these things, but here the British had a familiarity with battlefield conditions that we didn't possess. And it is like the tank procedure. The mobility machinery and all was superb because we'd had this comparable experience with tractors and all that thing in the great wheat fields out in the West. But when it came to the question of using these planes, they put for the tanks, when it came to the battlefield equipment of the tanks, they were not arranged so they could be fought with efficiency. And I got my lineup from the British. So in the general arguments, I decided in favor of the Americans on everything that had to do with the mobility propulsion of the tanks, and I decided for the British on what they felt were the necessities of the interior arrangement of the tanks for fighting purposes. The same thing happened with these planes. When I looked into it, I discovered that the British found they couldn't use them because they were so vulnerable. Their defensive equipment was utterly lacking, and we then began sending each tank through the modification central at the section at the plant up at Seattle. And I went there several times to see what they were doing about it. So we had to modify every one of these planes before they were workable. Now I could much better have said that we gave those 15 planes to have a efficiency test. Whereas what I did say was something like that, but not a positive statement such as it developed could readily be made in the case of these tanks. This sort of thing occurred time and again. When it got into the ammunition, the machine guns in particular, we were short in every way on ammunition, small arms and a tank, and Congress was criticizing the chief of ordnance very heavily for insisting on a very conservative procedure because the British were planning similar orders in this country and doing the work very quickly. The ordnance people told me that they would get in trouble, that was being too hurriedly done. Well, it developed that was being hurriedly done. The guns froze, as it were, at high altitudes in the plains and couldn't be fired at all. And while they were using the British ammunition, though manufactured in this country, they had to turn back, and we had to issue some of our cherished small allotments that we had available for the few planes that we then had. When you get into these arguments of that nature, and they get into a political complex, it's extraordinarily difficult to handle the thing, because when they're pushing for something like that, logic flies out of the window, and you're up against a political procedure. In all of which, it seems to be the general attitude that the War Department is always stupid and everybody else brilliant. I must say, this used to make me tired. We were making an intensive study in anti-tank defense, both as to weapons and as to the method of employment, and following this up very carefully in the field of the large maneuvers that were going. We found in our early Army-Navy joint operations for landings that there was a complete lack of comprehension on both sides as to how to go about it. I remember seeing a letter from the commander of the fleet saying that they'd gone through this one exercise, in which I might say practically everything went wrong, but it was a great lesson to all of us. They couldn't do it again because it interfered with their training. Well, it's rather absurd when you look at the training to see that the hundreds and hundreds of landing operations they had to support and how very few battle actions at sea there were. I remember visiting the Air Corps' first efforts at having larger guns in the planes, and they had installed a 75 millimeter in this plane and are trying to work out how they could use it. This sort of thing I was after all the time. But there were so many different facets to the procedure when it came to the work of the planes in support of ground operations, that is very easy to say, but the great trouble was there were almost no planes available for use in these demonstrations for the operations in support of troops. We had so few that we had to take almost all of them away from the Air Corps training to do this other thing, which put a very grave difficulty in our way and set up a very positive postures on both sides of the fence. You refer to Colonel Borden and weapons for jungle warfare. I took this up, see what I could do to increase the support of the ground troops and lessen the casualty rates in the way of heavier gunfire. They were then fighting north of Guadalcanal on above Russell Island and on beyond that. I've forgotten the names of the places at the present time. And I brought Borden in and told him to figure out what could be done with existing things. We couldn't go at something that was a year to produce. There had to be something that he could get it in shape in a month or even less. And I remember some of the things that he did do. One of the principal ones was to take the amount of anti-aircraft ammunition for the 80-millimeter gun, I think it was 80-millimeter, and by shaving it down, get it so that it would fit a trench mortar that we had. That gave us a heavy artillery fire close up to the front line in the jungle, and therefore was very valuable. There were a number of things of like nature that he worked up. And then I would send him over, wherever it was. Later it was Italy, I remember, but then it was to the Pacific. And he'd have these things all displayed. And I had them bring in the principal officers, and I had them bring in the sergeants. And they could indicate what they wanted right there. He'd take the order, and that would be shipped the next day from San Francisco. And we followed that up at great length. First was this something that could be done quickly, like just shaving down the side of a shell. And the next was having it available, so if the man looked at it and said, I'll take that, and then the order would go to San Francisco to put that on the boat and send it out there. We carried this to a great extent in Italy. And the high commanders there, the field marshals and all, came down to inspect and pick out the what they thought might be usable. The various items that are mentioned by you here in that main paragraph of yours, I recall, I don't know just what to say about them, but they were being pushed in every way possible. And when I sent a man like Borden over to the Ordnance Proving Grounds, I gave him a priority procedure that they would have to accept. Mr. Stimson got interested in this, and he had a man doing the same thing later. I pretty much answered this question right then. There were a number of weapons in which I had a direct interest, but I don't know how to separate them apart at this moment. 16, discussion over the Jeep. The best witness in this is General Bedell Smith. He was then Secretary of the General Staff. During a conference I was having with a number of generals, he came into my office, which was his privilege, and interrupted to say that there was a man in his office that had just come in who'd invented a small vehicle that Smith thought was excellent, but he'd been unable to get any favorable observations from the quartermaster corps, from the field artillery, regarding which he'd been very hopeful, and from the air corps. So they'd sent him from Judge Patterson's office down to my office, and he came into Smith. He was pretty irate, I guess. He was an Irishman. And he wanted to give one of these small motors as a sample and have us test it. And Smith took about 3 minutes to state this. And I said, well, what do you think of it? And he said, I think it's good. Well, I said, do it. The conversation's just about that long. Well, he said, it isn't that simple. We couldn't get along unless we had about 15 of them. Well, I said, how much did it cost? And he gave me the estimated cost. And I said, if you could find the money. And he said he thought he could. Well, then I said, you do it. And he went back. And then he came in about 4 or 5 minutes later and interrupted us again. I said, what's the trouble now, Smith? Well, he said, I should have said it before, but I say it now. That's the first damn time we've been able to get anything for this fella in this whole War Department. And I think it's worthy of special comment. That was the Jeep. First thing I heard of it after that was the tests at the quartermaster field depot near Baltimore. And it was called by some other name, and a lot of photographs in the rotogravure section of the paper. And on inquiry, I discovered that was this Jeep, and these were manufacturing it. Well, Smith handled the distribution. He sent five, I think, to the Fort Knox, to the tank corps. And the chief of the tank corps replied that he could give the reply without the test. And Smith told him, well, he'd have to have the test, and I'd ordered it. As I recall the incident, 2 weeks later, he asked for $38,000. From that time on, the request for the Jeeps dismounted and mounted. The artillery wanted some. Quartermaster, of course, wanted some. All these people that had turned it down all wanted some. That was the Jeep, as I recall it, but Smith can confirm this. The ordnance was conservative. too conservative, I would say, but at the same time, it had to insist on a certain precision that the line officers objected to as too prolonged. But the reason for this showed up crystal clear when we were dealing with machine guns for the anti-aircraft, and we had to use machine guns that are being built in various arsenals around the country for the British, who accepted a very much lower standard than the ordnance insisted upon. And they found every one of these froze at high altitudes and couldn't be used. And then, as I said before, they came back and called on us for some of our small reserve. Well, the chief of ordnance was being very heavily criticized by everybody interested in this matter in Congress. Matter of fact, he was absolutely right. And you had to do this thing with a great deal of care and a great deal of examination and test, all of which were thrown to the wind when they wanted something badly, and they were arguing to get it regardless of what the conditions were. Another thing was the archaic machinery they had. I remember when I was questioning, I think I've told this already, when I was investigating as deputy chief of staff the setup of the ordnance and trying to find out from them personally what they wanted, I discovered they had some machines that had been in there for 50 years. And in other words, the whole setup needed revamping. One reason was the extreme lack of funds. There were just almost nothing in the Army appropriations that permitted you to go ahead on anything. Stop it. 18. As to the developments of the General Staff in connection with General March and General Pershing, I think the estimates and statements in the preceding paragraph are reasonably correct. I found in going into all the papers afterwards and in some of the actions which occurred at the time which I saw General March personally, that he was a master administrator, an executive, with a great weakness of antagonizing everybody, and in particular in having men about him, one in particular, who were very curt and almost rude in their procedure. They operated too much like General March. They needed someone of exactly opposite characteristics as the Secretary of the General Staff and in other words. I admired General March very much in his basic procedure, but I thought he thought himself, almost ruined himself by his bitterness in his procedure, which stuck with him to the last. The one point about the General Staff has to be remembered, that while they had the power of selection there very high, that the selection abroad were much more effective than the selections of individuals on this side, whether that was due to the fact that they're close to the combat and all of that sort of thing. But nevertheless, that was the case. As to Mr. Baker, I'll say that he was the greatest American, or I'll put it, the greatest mind that I came in contact with in my lifetime. I never saw Mr. Wilson, so I can't comment on that. But I had a number of conversations, intimate conversations, with Mr. Baker, and I admired him beyond any other man that I've ever known. He rode a very difficult horse there between General Pershing and General March and did it extraordinarily well. He is the most penetrating observer of Army facts and fancies, as it were, and we couldn't have had a better man as Secretary of War. And of course, when he made a presentation, his English, handling of the English language, was superb. I have nothing more to add about the disagreement between General March and General Pershing. I don't know how much was General Pershing's fault, because I didn't join him till the feud had well built up. But I thought on General March's part, he might have been much more moderate in his procedure. However, I think they're both at fault, because it was essential that they get together, and they didn't. And what saved the situation was Newton Baker. As nearly as I can recall, my first intimate worry about Germany and Japan was when I was in the Philippines in 21. Frankly, I don't recall just when I became worried. 22. I had a very distant reaction to Mr. Roosevelt's speech in 37. In fact, I don't recall analyzing it at all. I don't care to answer that. 24, I don't know enough about all the details to answer that. I don't care to answer it. 25. All I know about the innocence inquiry is that we weren't able to use any of the free money, as it were, which Hugh Johnson had proposed that we should use for an immediate manufacture by the heavy industries of a lot of heavy armament. That's the Lindbergh's report. I don't think that was fatal in any way. It was very informative. I knew Lindbergh, talked with him. I remember driving him home from a dinner at General Arnold's one night, and I heard so much of that sort of thing, it didn't make a profound impression on me. As a matter of fact, one very distinguished citizen, still in the forefront, as it were, came to me in about 1941, and advised me very strongly not to ask these large sums of money from Congress, because we couldn't possibly go into the war. We didn't have a chance of defeating the Germans and getting into the Western Europe, and it was all a tremendous waste of money and a very serious involvement. Well, I can't answer that. Everybody has to be the judge.